The Fred Allen Show. Brought to you by Pana Toothpaste for the smile of beauty, Sal Hepatica for the smile of health. With Fred Allen, folks, 3,600 seconds of fun and music. Fun with our star comedian, Fred Allen. With our guest star, Bob Benchley. Music with Peter Van Steeden, the Merry Man, and Wynn Murray. The time has come. It's the Fred Allen Show. The curtain goes up, Peter raises his baton for overture, and it's good morning. Ladies and gentlemen, is a young man who has just caught 1939 under the mistletoe and is preparing to kiss the old year goodbye. Here he is, Fred Allen, in person.
Thank you. Thank you. How did you enjoy your Christmas? Did you make the welkin ring again this year?
Yes, sir, Fred.
Enjoyed yourself, huh?
Oh, say, I've had high old times at Christmas, Fred. Yeah. But I think the high old time I had this Christmas was higher than any high old times I ever had. Oh. And I've had some high old times.
You had a high old time.
Yes, sir.
Well, did you hang up your stocking this year?
Oh, you bet, Fred.
What happened?
Well, nothing. I just put it back on again in the morning.
Hey, you're lucky. I put my stocking back on and stepped in 3 jelly beans. I had to send the stocking over to Schraff's to get it laundered, Harry.
Well, that's the best. Oh, say, Fred, I'm sorry. I forgot. Thanks a lot for your present. That turkey stuffing.
Oh, the turkey? You got the turkey stuffing.
Yes,
how was it? How was it, Harry? How did it taste?
Well, that I can't say, Fred. The zipper on the turkey got stuck, and we had to nibble around the outside. We couldn't get the turkey open.
Oh, isn't that a joke?
Merry December 27th, folks.
Hey, what?
You can't tell what'll happen.
What if somebody should put a weather strip on that door? Things are creeping in here when you don't... What is that, a merry December 27th? Are you making your own holidays, Mr. Van Steeden?
No, but I didn't see you fellas Christmas.
Well, that's all right,
all
Steve.
Right, me.
Did you have a good Christmas, Harry?
Oh, I had a high old time, Steve.
He's had high old times, but the high old time. He got altitude with this last high old time. But what? From his looks, I don't think he's grounded yet, as a matter of fact. What sort of a day did you have, Mr. Van Steeden?
I was going all day.
Okay.
Christmas carols, community sings, solos around in people's backyards.
Oh, you spent the whole day singing, Pete?
I must have sung Abdul Abubula Mea 200 times, Harry.
Abdul Abubula.
What kind of a carol is that? What has Abdul the Bulbul Amir got to do with Christmas?
Abdul's a Turk.
Yeah.
Turks come from Turkey, and Turkey goes with Christmas.
Well, I can't say that.
I'll join you outside as soon as I wind this up. What did you sing for an encore? Cranberry Me Not on the Lone Prairie?
Okay, Alan, just for that, here's your loaf of bread, thanks.
Thanks.
What's that?
Alan gave me a loaf of bread for Christmas.
A loaf of bread?
He said if somebody gave me an electric toaster for Christmas, I'd be sitting pretty.
Well, just because you didn't get the toaster, you don't have to give me this bread back, Van Steeden. I don't.
A crumb will feel more at home with a loaf of bread than I will.
He who tells a joke and runs away will live to tell a joke some other day. And he who has the last laugh in radio is but a music cue, Mr. Van Steeden. And with this sage rejoinder, left over from Harry's turkey stuffing, we turn to the latest news of the week. The Ipana News presents The World in Review. New York City, New York. Selznick International production of Gone with the Wind, the motion picture eagerly awaited by millions who read the book, has triumphant opening in New York City. Celebrities involved in making a picture are acclaimed by press and public. Ipana News interviews some of the little fellows whose names didn't come up at the opening, but whose activities made Gone with the Wind possible. First, Mr. Mervyn Nod. What about this sensational picture, Mr. Nod?
Why, if it wasn't for me, Gone with the Wind would never have been made.
Well, I didn't see your name among the screen credits. Mr. Selznick produced the picture, didn't he?
Yes.
Victor Fleming directed it.
Yes.
Max Steiner wrote the music.
Yes.
Walter Plunkett designed the costume.
Yes.
And still you...
Yes. I maintain that the man who really started the ball rolling was little old yours truly, Mervyn Nod.
You?
Yes. I, Mervyn Nod, said the one word that made the picture possible.
Well, how did it happen?
Well, it was 3 years ago in March. Yes. Mr. Selznick buzzed for me.
You flew to his office?
Yes.
And?
Mr. Selznick was reading the last page of a book. I stood at his desk. Mr. Selznick finished reading. He put the book on his desk. He raised his eyes to mine.
And said?
Mervyn, he said, this book will make a great picture. I met his glance. I said, yes.
And that is what started Gone with the Wind?
Yes.
If you had said no that morning, what would have happened?
I'd have been fired. I'm a yes man.
Aren't we all? And
yes.
Thank you, Mr. Mervyn.
Yes.
Yes and yes to you. The man at the studio who had the most trouble with the picture was a gentleman named Humphrey Dill. Mr. Dill.
I've been 30 years in the picture game, and I never seen nothing like I've been through on Gone with the Wind.
Well, what is it you do at the studio, Mr. Dill?
I'm the adjective man.
The adjective man?
Yeah. When a producer finishes a picture, he turns in the details to me.
Oh, and you?
I make up an adjective to fit the picture.
Well, I still don't.
Look, I'll explain it.
Oh, all right.
Supposing the studio finishes a picture called Chaos Over Potsdam.
Yeah.
The producer gives me the details. I see it ain't colossal. I see there ain't no adjective to describe Chaos Over Potsdam.
What do you do?
I use a word like significant. This picture is significant. You can take it either way.
Oh, I see. But about Gone with the Wind.
Well, Mr. Selznick, give me the details.
They were stupendous.
It's the biggest thing to come out of Hollywood. So I start going through my adjectives.
And?
I ain't got an adjective in my repertoire big enough to fit it.
What about colossal?
Colossal, titanic, mammoth, brobdignagian, cyclopean. For the first time in my life, they won't do.
So?
So I started compounding adjectives like Titan gigantuan.
Yeah.
Super, super colossic.
Yeah.
Glamagnificent.
Those are pretty big words.
Not big enough for this picture. I seen it was futile. I dismantled the adjectives I was working on.
And gave up?
I had to. The picture's too big for white.
And Gone with the Wind has been released without an adjective?
I'm just calling it a long picture, mister.
A masterpiece of understatement. And thank you, Mr. Humphrey Dill. An actress who almost played the part of Scarlet in Gone with the Wind is Miss Stephanie Culpepper. How did you miss out on the Scarlet part, Miss Culpepper?
I was too thorough, sugar.
Too thorough?
I sure enough was. I got too deep into the character. That was my undoing.
What happened?
Well, back in 1935, the studio called me for a test. I thought they were just auditioning draws.
Oh, I see.
I met the director, Mr. Somebody. He says, honey, your drawl is bragging. If you can act like you can drawl, he said, the part is yours.
And you did a scene from the picture?
With the camera right there.
Oh, and what was the trouble?
I was too thorough.
How do you mean, Miss Culpepper?
Well, the director said, play Scarlet as a green kid.
Yes.
Your future looks black. And you're feeling blue.
Yes.
Lose your courage and turn yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Then steal yourself and show you're in the pink.
A complicated bit of acting, I must say.
Yes. Scarlet was green, black, blue, yellow, and pink. That's the way I played her. But I was too thorough.
How do you mean?
Well, the test was in Technicolor. I come out plaid.
Oh. Condolences, and thank you, Miss Stephanie Culpepper. The only boner found in the entire picture was traced to one Mr. Belclair Scriven, How did this boner possibly creep in, Mr. Scriven?
It was my fault. It was a fatal literary lapse.
Oh, a literary. Oh, did you write the picture scenario?
Me? Why? One man couldn't write Gone with the Wind. It was a creative project.
Really? Well, how was the picture written?
60 workers, writers, working day and night in 12-hour shifts.
You don't say.
Yes, I do. The script passed along on an assembly line.
Yes.
Hack writers put in verbs and conjunctions.
Yes.
Literary big shots voted on sentences. The chap who did whole paragraphs was pure cement.
And your task was?
I was a suffix clincher.
Oh, you just added the suffixes.
Yes, for instance, if the word child passed me on the assembly note, I would add hood. Childhood.
Yes.
Sweet, I'd add nest.
Sweetness.
Nuff, I'd add ing.
The word nuff.
Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that ing.
But about this single boner in Gone with the Wind.
It is a missing suffix. It was my fatal lapse.
How did it happen?
I had been working 27 days and nights without sleeping. I was suffix happy.
I can imagine.
We were coming into that scene where Scarlet meets Red for the first time. I was sitting at the assembly belt. I started nodding.
Yes.
Butt came by, I added the lure. Butler.
Yes.
Scar came by, I added the let. Scarlet.
Yes.
Then she spoke. And I must have dozed off.
You missed the suffix?
I did, yes. Scarlet said hello. I didn't add the O.
And when Scarlet greets Rhett in the picture today...
It's a bugle call.
I see. And what picture are you working on now, Mr. Scriven?
I am not with MGM at the moment.
Well, where will a letter reach you?
Care of the menswear in Macy's basement.
And still you're no bargain, Mr. Belclair Scriven. And now the Arpana News brings you a digest version of the masterpiece Gone with the Wind. Running to 1,037 pages in book form, lasting 3 hours and 45 minutes on the screen, Gone with the Wind is here through the miracle of radio, given to you in 3 seconds, presenting our condensation of Gun with the Wind. The gun with the wind. Thank you. Thank you. We have some fife players in here, too. And now as long as the drum corps doesn't show up, we're all right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Merry Mags, who have picked up a sideline and are singing at the Paramount Theater this week, close in on our microphone to render Santa Claus's theme song, Jingle Bells.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, and laughing all the way. Bells on bobtail ring, making spirits bright. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight. Jingle bells, jingle bells,
and misfortune seemed his lot. He ran the sleigh into a drifted bank, and we got a stop. Jingle, 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 jingle all the way, oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh. Jingle, jingle, jingle bell, jingle all the way, all the way, oh, what fun it is to ride in one horse open sleigh. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, since we are still knee-deep in the holiday season, this is a good time.
Here it comes. Here it comes. Now we'll have a little more Merry Christmas and a big dash, a Happy New Year. Personally, I'd like a little Arbor Day for a change.
What's the trouble, chum, if I may call you chum?
Oh, no trouble at all, only I don't like holidays.
Oh, come now, not even this in-between time?
Especially this in-between time. The more I think of the presents I got, the madder I get.
Really?
Some neckties that had come in handy if you had a flag of stripes. Pardon me. Some cigars that are guaranteed to rid the house of termites and a lot of bills that'll take me to spring. Don't look now, but I'm getting a cold for New Year's, so maybe you've noticed.
Well, if Fred didn't, I did, chum. Chum. Seriously, I can tell you what to do for your cold. Take Tal Hepatica to help fight that cold faster. And to substantiate that statement, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to pass along the results of a recent impartial survey among physicians conducted by leading medical journals. In this survey, it was found that 7 out of 10 physicians prescribe a saline laxative when treating a cold. And Sal Hepatica is, we believe, the outstanding saline laxative in America. There are 2 very good reasons for this, which you can check with your own doctor. First,
Sal Hepatica acts quickly, yet it is exceptionally gentle.
And remember, since the progress of a cold is quick, this greater speed of Sal Hepatica is especially important in fighting it. Second,
Sal Hepatica also helps nature counteract the acidity that so often accompanies a cold.
So you see, Sal Hepatica helps in 2 ways, and helps faster. Get an economical bottle of Sal Hepatica from your druggist before another day goes by. Then, whenever a cold threatens, just take 2 teaspoonfuls of Sal Hepatica in a glass of water. Help nature get you through the new year with less time out for colds, with gentle, quick-acting Sal Hepatica.
Van Steeden and his Artana Ickies have just played. They've given us the Reader's Digest version of It Had to Be You. And now, ladies and gentlemen, before we present our guest star...
Mr. Allen!
Yes. Oh, yes, Portland.
Mama sent this back.
Sent what? Oh, what's this little bar?
It's that perfume you gave Mama for Christmas.
Oh, doesn't your mother like perfume?
Yes, but Mama said this kind was for throwing, not using.
What does your mother mean, throwing?
Mama said this perfume is generally put up in little glass bowls instead of in bottles.
Did your mother try it?
Yes. Mama put some on her dress.
And?
3 moths came out of her skirt and gave themselves up.
What do you know?
Then Mama got too near the candles on the Christmas tree.
And?
Her left sleeve exploded.
Nothing else happened, I hope.
Well, not till Mama rubbed some of the perfume behind her ears.
And then what happened?
Mama's right ear came off in her hand.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
That's what Mama said when her other ear came off.
Your mother said what?
It's ridiculous.
Why, now, wait a minute. This whole thing is getting ridiculous. Who is our guest star tonight?
Well, all of the other programs are having guest experts sum up the old year and predict for 1940.
Oh, and don't tell me that you have dug up a whimsy expert for us.
Yes, he's America's foremost authority on wit and humor.
To wit?
Mr. Robert Bentley.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, good evening, Mr. Benchley.
Yes, as evenings go, I'd say it is a good evening, friend. That is up to now. The thing that worries me is what happens from now on.
Why, we could have had the censor up to clear your throat, you know. Everything else was...
I could have sworn that wasn't there.
We had everything else cleared but your throat for the program. Well, the... You all ready?
Oh, I guess as ready as I will be.
I know, when the frog's away, the... Well, the purpose of this meeting is to dissect humor and the professional humorist. Now, tonight, Mr. Benchley, you are the guinea pig.
Well, it's a character part for me, Fred, but I'll do the best I can. A guinea pig. Gosh, I wish you'd told me how to come in tail.
That joke isn't a sample of your humor, Mr. Benchley.
No, Fred, I was just feeling out the audience. Uh-huh. That joke was sort of a throwaway, you know?
Well, it's too bad you didn't throw it away before you got in here.
Yeah, I'll know better next time, if there is a next time. Well, as Robespierre said on the steps of the guillotine, tu comprends et tu pardonnes.
What does that mean, Mr. Benchley?
What?
I said, what does that say to whatever that was? What does it mean?
Well, it loses so much in the translation, Fred. Why bother?
Fine. Well, we'll get right into our interview.
All right. I'm still the guinea pig.
If you don't mind.
No, not at all. I just wanted to make sure. If I'm supposed to be a guinea pig and play it as a mongoose, it's going to sound rather confusing.
Yes, it is.
Well, that's all I've got to say.
Oh, you must have more to say than that, Mr. Benchley.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I have. What I meant was that's all I've got to say on this page. I'm turning now.
Oh. Considerate of you, Mr. Benchley, I'm sure.
Well, that's all right. May I trouble you to wet my finger, please?
Why, not at all. Pardon my tongue.
Certainly. Pardon my finger. There we are. I've turned.
Fine. Now, tell me, is it true that you are America's foremost authority on wit and humor?
Well, I don't like to come right out and say it, Fred, but I'm not the one to make it unanimous either. But millions of people are saying it, and where there's so much smoke, there must be some fire.
Yes, I'll say. Now, how did you get this reputation?
Oh, I forget. I happened to be standing at a bar one night.
Standing?
Yes, it was early in the evening.
Oh.
Someone said, that Benchley is the world's foremost authority on wit and humor. I forget who said it. It may have been me. I don't know.
It started as a rumor then.
Yes. I picked it up and sort of blabbed the word around. The thing caught on, and overnight, you might say, I was made.
Well, did you come from a funny family?
Yes, I did. We used to get a lot of laughs around the house just looking at each other. My father was a belly laugh.
Even as you today are no titter. As John Hancock used to put it on occasion, c'est la physiognomie.
What does that mean, Fred?
Well, it loses so much. But tell me, Mr. Benchley, when did you first start to get funny?
My first bright remark, historians tell me, was made at a baby show in Worcester, Massachusetts in 1894.
You recall it?
Verbatim.
Good.
I won first prize at the baby show. The judge stooped over my cradle with the medal.
Uh-huh.
I said, you can't pin anything on me. My mother beat you to it.
Rollicking, I must say.
Thank you.
That started you on your career as combination wit and Merry Andrew.
Yes, Fred. The rest is history. I rested on my laurels for 20 years.
And what happened?
My spine blossomed. In 1930, I won first prize at the flower show, standing on my hand.
Good for you. Now, since you are an authority, Mr. Benchley, I think our listeners might enjoy having you clear up a few minor things, including your throat. You want to take time
out? No, it's okay.
We'd like to have you clear up a few minor things about... you don't think part of your mustache got down there. And I think our listeners might enjoy having you clear up a few minor things about wit and humor that tend to confuse the average person.
Oh, I'll be glad to, Fred. What's on your mind?
Well, first, what is a joke?
A joke? Well, when you hear a man say, did you hear the one about, then he goes,
yes.
Well, what comes between, did you hear the one about, and that's the joke.
Well, that explains everything. Have you any statistics on wit and humor covering 1939?
Well, I did have, but Dr. Gallup borrowed my pole this morning. He was behind in his shinnying or something. But I have a few loose ends in my head.
Oh, I thought those were your sideburns.
Oh, they're just old loose ends. They've got hair on them.
They ought to come in mighty handy, but tugging. Well, what joke, according to your loose ends, was told the most last year?
The Joe Miller survey rates as the outstanding joke of 1939. That one where one Albanian says to the other Albanian, what's the best way to keep a dead fish from smelling?
Does the second Albanian answer?
Unfortunately, yes. The second Albanian says the best way to keep a dead fish from smelling is to cut off its nose.
Where does the... where does the joke come in?
Well, no one seems to know. I've had a dead fish in my lab all year working on that joke. I cut off the nose.
And does the fish smell?
I doubt it. Everyone else is complaining, but the fish apparently gives no evidence of resenting itself.
Then the outstanding joke of 1939 is founded on a fallacy.
Exactly. Cutting off the fish's nose would have no effect on its olfactory reception whatsoever.
But the essence of a joke is still involved.
Yes, the joke is that a fish smells through its gills.
Well concealed, I must say.
Yes, the nose obviously is cut off as a come-on. But that's the trend. That joke is number one on the wit parade.
Now, what is your favorite joke of all time, Mr. Benchley?
Oh, I've said so many funny things, Fred.
I know, but your favorite.
Well, I guess it's that one about the little Indian boy who got his foot caught in his papoose bag and couldn't get it out.
What happened?
The boy had to go through life living on his mother.
Very.
Thank you, thank you.
Excuse me if I don't laugh, Mr. Benchley. We're pressed for time.
I understand quite.
Well, what would you say is the outlook for wit and humor in 1940?
The outlook is pretty drab, Fred. I'm giving up the game. In fact, I'm going into another business. Christmas present consultant.
What is a Christmas present consultant?
Well, if you receive a Christmas present that presents a problem for a nominal sum, I'll solve it for you.
Well, how do you mean?
Well, I got a call this morning up on Central Park West. A man received 20 pounds of putty for Christmas.
Really?
He didn't know what to do with it.
He called you in?
At 3 o'clock this morning.
An emergency. What did you do?
Well, I broke every window in this client's apartment. That 20 pounds of putty was gone in no time.
Pretty soft for you.
Yeah, I sure made an impression there.
Good.
I had another call. A man received a grand piano for Christmas. His apartment was too small. With the piano in it, the man was sleeping in the hall.
What was your solution?
I burned the legs of the piano in the fireplace, took the piano up on end.
Yes?
Today, that man has a harp and a place to sleep. Well, it's all in the day's work, friend.
Yes, I guess it is. Have you been successful with all of your clients?
I'm infallible, Fred. Why, only yesterday, I was called in by a family on the drive.
What was wrong there?
They were playing bridge on a new table, a Christmas present.
Uh-huh.
They had open house, and a bum walked in and got in the bridge game. They sent for me.
Were you able to get the bum out of the bridge game?
Oh, in no time. I arrived at the house. They dealt me in.
Yes?
I did one no tramp.
Yes?
The bum blushed and withdrew.
Amazing, Mr. Benchley, but this is a seasonal profession. I suppose when Christmas is over, you'll return to your public.
Yes, Fred. As a matter of fact, I'm leaving for Hollywood next week.
Oh, are you going to make another picture?
Oh, I've got to. The studio just discovered it has two dishes left over. Well, bonsoir, Fred.
Bonsoir? What does that mean?
It leaves so much in the translation.
Well, I get it. Thank you. I get it, but vaguely. And thank you, Mr. Robert Benchley. Thank you. Thank you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Miss Wynne Murray, dressed in her best bib and tucker, is here to sing for us Great Day.
When you're down and out, lift up your head and shout, there's gonna be a great day. When skies were dark, came Noah's Ark. Amen.
At this point, ladies and gentlemen...
Excuse me, Mr. Rudd. I got a special package for this gentleman here, Fred Allen.
No, this is the microphone. I'm Fred Allen.
Oh, sorry. My sticks are a mite misty yet. Oh, they're careful now. That package is marked for Jilly.
Well, I'll treat it tenderly.
All right.
Why, it's a phonograph record to Fred Allen and Company from Harry Von Zell, a New Year's greeting. You mind if we play it now, Harry?
No, of course not. Go ahead.
Will you put this record on the machine, Ted?
Here it goes.
Fred, I sincerely hope you in Portland and everyone else on the show start 1940 happy and healthy, and that you'll stay that way throughout the year. And any time you feel a cold coming on, I know you'll do the wise thing and fight that cold faster with sparkling Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica.
Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica.
Sal
Hepatica.
Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Because in the first place, Sal Hepatica is speedy, yet it is very gentle. And speed, you know, is mighty important in fighting a cold. And just as important, Sal Hepatica also helps nature counteract the acidity that so frequently accompanies a cold. So in two ways, Sal Hepatica helps fight cold and helps faster. Remember that 7 out of 10 doctors prescribe a saline laxative in treating a cold. And Sal Hepatica is, we believe, America's outstanding saline laxative. So for faster action against colds, see that your medicine cabinet is never without gentle, quick-acting Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica. Sal Hepatica.
Show will continue immediately following a brief pause for your station identification. Ladies and gentlemen, the question of the week. This is Mr. and Mrs. Average Man's Round Table, where three persons selected from our studio audience are invited to give their opinions on a question that concerns some prominent issue of the day. These little sessions are entirely unrehearsed. Ted takes his place now at the round table where he meets his fellow debaters for the first time. Are you ready over there, Fred?
Yes, Harry. The forum is declared officially open. And Portland will introduce our first member.
Yes, Mr. William Friedman from the Bronx.
Well, good evening, Mr. Friedman.
Good evening, Mr. Allen.
May I? I thought for a minute you had borrowed Mr. Bentley's frog there, but I guess everything's going to be all right.
I have no mustache.
Well, he hasn't much left. I guess most of it's in his throat. But I was going to ask you, do you mind if I ask you what your profession is?
I'm a lawyer.
A lawyer, really? Well, it's too bad. If I'd known you were coming up, I'd have borrowed 3 or 4 cases from the Goodwill Court, so you'd have felt more at home. But tell me, did you graduate from a law school here in New York City?
No, I come from an out-of-town law school.
An out-of-town? You wouldn't care to name it?
Oh, yes, Harvard Law School.
Oh, Harvard. Oh, yeah, that's up near where we live up there. Harvard turns out some mighty good men. Not in football, but I mean in the law school. I knew a fellow who was a very brilliant student at the Harvard Law School. He finished his 4 years in 3 years, sued the college, and got his 4th-year tuition back. But I was going to ask you, Mr. Friedman, would it be unethical if I were to ask you for some professional advice here in public? I'm not getting your fee ready. I mean, I just have to take this out.
No, I don't think it would be unethical.
Well, I have a legal problem that's been bothering me. Did you hear Jack Benny's program last Sunday night?
No, I'm sorry. I missed that one, Fred.
Did you hear it the week before?
Yes, the week before I heard it.
Oh, you're one of the every other week Benny listeners. Well, the sooner everybody feels that way, the better off it'll be for me. He'll have to have us in. But when I was going to ask you last week on his program, you know, Jack, Benny, and I are supposed to make a picture together next summer for Paramount. And last Sunday night on his program, he called up the Paramount Studios, Mr. Mark Sandridge, the producer there, and said that he refused to make a picture with me. Now, can I, have I any legal rights involved there? Can I protect myself?
Well, absolutely. I'd sue him for everything under the sun.
Well, I don't think he's got all of that yet. Suing him for everything under the sun would take in all of his California holdings. I get those. But you think I can sue him? He can't run out on me, huh?
No, I chase him through every state in the Union.
Well, of course, I doubt if he'd last that long. It's uphill in Montana. But do you think, as long as I can sue him, do you think that if we make the picture, that Paramount can sue Benny and me later?
Well, that depends on the movie critics.
That depends on the picture. Well, thank you a lot, Mr. Friedman. Now, Portland.
Mr. Thomas Broadley from Brooklyn.
Good evening, Mr. Broadley.
Good evening, Mr. Allen.
You, well, that's a nice, you brought your own studio audience with you.
My own gang.
Well, that's the coming thing. A lot of the radio comedians have portable studio audiences they carry around with them. But I was going to ask you, what do you do over in Brooklyn?
I'm the manager of a garage.
Oh, a garage, are you? What do you, how's business?
Rotten.
It is?
Very bad.
Well, don't you think there are not enough cars in the country today?
Yeah, there's plenty of cars, but they're not running them.
Oh, you're just buying the cars and leaving them in front of the house. Well, that makes work for the policemen. They nicely come around and give everyone tickets. Well, thank you a lot, Mr. Broadley. The vice president is waving at me. My time is rapidly disappearing here. Next, Portland.
Mr. Wesley Fraser from Astoria, Long Island.
Good evening, Mr. Fraser. Oh, you have a small audience.
Just one.
Well, maybe after the program, your following will improve. And may I ask your business if I'm not too nosy?
Yes, I'm a haberdasher, friend.
Oh, a haberdasher?
A haberdasher.
Well, I guess you're pretty well tired out after the Christmas
party. Very tired, yes.
You are, huh? I have been so many jokes about neckties on the program, I was going to ask you, I hope that you hadn't foisted any on your customers to give away for Christmas.
No, that's one thing I don't do.
The customer's always right. I got a necktie this year. It looks like a sun-kissed antipasto. It's worth about $1. I'll have to spend $2 for a muffler, I guess, to hide it, so I lose it. Well, thank you a lot, Mr. Fraser, and that brings us to our question. Tonight's question is sort of a double feature. It concerns a marital problem, and in order that husbands and wives may both have a go at it, we're going to use the same question again next Wednesday. Now, tonight, our board members consist of three married men. You are married, Mr. Friedman.
Yes, Mr. Allen.
And Mr. Broadley.
Yes, sir, Mr. Allen.
And Mr. Fraser.
That's right.
You're all married. We're all married, and I'm the only one who looks it. Our question tonight is, after living together 50 weeks each year, when the two-week vacation period arrives in the summer, should husbands and wives take their vacations together, or should they go their separate ways and enjoy a real vacation alone? Now, Mr. Friedman, do you think married couples should take their vacations alone?
No, I think they should take... Mr. Allen, I mean, they should take it alone.
They should separate at vacation time.
Absolutely.
And now the husbands had no trouble. I sensed the husbands were going to organize. You think that the couple should take their vacations alone?
Yes, I do, Fred. And the reason, I presume you'd like to know?
Yes, I would.
Well, I think that if they separate, they'll appreciate each other all the more when they get together.
When they get...
After the vacation is over.
Well, thank you.
They'll forget about the rolling pins and things.
All right, thank you, Mr. Friedman. And Mr. Broadley, what do you think about
this? Well, you got me on the spot, Fred. My wife is sitting right here.
If you can't get back in the house tonight, you can come home with me. Just tell us how you feel about it, Mr. Broadley.
Well, I think a husband should take his wife with him.
You thought you'd go away together?
Absolutely. I have to say it.
I have to say it, huh? Well, how do you feel about it, Mr. Fraser?
Well, I definitely think they should take them separate.
They should take their vacation
Absolutely.
Separate. And why do you say that?
Well, as you say, after 50 weeks together, I think they should separate. It gives them a chance to get a sort of a mental house cleaning, if you know what I mean? To think back to the arguments and things like that.
And they should separate. Well, that is two for taking separate vacations, and Mr. Broadleaf, whose wife is here and is speaking under duress, I should go away. Well, they seem to have decided, our married men, that the ideal vacation for married couples, 2-1, is to take their vacations together. Now, next week, we're inviting 3 wives to give us their opinions. The week after that, I'll probably have to hide. Our forum closes with on a note of suspense, and thank you, gentlemen, for your kind cooperation. Thank you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Merrimacks, who, since we have heard from them early in the program, have done 4 shows at the Paramount, return to sing Oh, Johnny, Oh.
This coming Monday, in order to justify my sobriquet, Public Philanthropist Number 1, I'm going to toss a little New Year's dinner for everyone on this program.
Oh, thanks.
Now, wait a minute. It won't be elaborate, you understand. Just the turkey so tender, it will collapse gracefully at the mere sight of the carving set. Ruby red cranberry sauce, pearly creamed onions, mashed potatoes whipped to a frothy frenzy.
Fred, you aren't forgetting anything, are you?
Well, I thought you'd take the turkey stuffing and the plum pudding for granted, Harry.
No, Fred. What I meant was that you're going to have so many soft, creamy, well-cooked foods.
Well, what would you suggest, Herschel?
I pan a toothpaste and massage.
Not for New Year's dinner, Harry.
No, of course not for New Year's dinner, Fred. For every day in the new year, because so many of the foods we all eat, delicious as they are too soft to give our gums... are too soft to give our gums the work they have to have for healthy firmness. And as a result, gums are apt to grow tender and touchy and flash a warning signal, a tinge of pink on your toothbrush. When you see that, see your dentist. Quite often, his verdict will simply be,
your gums have grown lazy from lack of exercise. They need more stimulation to keep them firm and healthy.
And very often, as so many dentists do, he will add,
your gums will respond to the healthful stimulation of Ipana toothpaste and massage.
So adopt this easy, modern dental routine. Massage with Ipana. Help to keep your teeth brighter, your gums firmer, and naturally, your smile one of winning charm. Tomorrow, without fail, go to your druggist for an economical tube of Ipana toothpaste.
Thank you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the farewell appearance of the mighty Alan R. Players for 1939. Tonight, they dramatize an episode filched from the secret clinical files of a famous psychoanalyst. The sketch is called... and neurosis. Or the patient was the well-dressed man, his straitjacket had a belt in the back. Now the action takes place.
Professor Allen, psychoanalysis clinic.
The time?
The present.
The character?
Professor Allen, Professor Allen's nurse, several patients, and Napoleon.
Napoleon? Who's Napoleon?
I'm Napoleon.
Professor Allen's mental clinic, happy in addition, hello? No, Professor Allen just went out. He said he had to see a man about a dogma. Yes, I'll tell him. Goodbye.
Oh, a Freudian good morning, nurse. And how are all my subnormal patients this morning?
They're still subnormal. They're asking for you.
Only a suppressed schizophrenic would attempt to belittle the world's greatest authority on psychoanalysis, nurse. Why, my cures have set the Ouija board back 20 years.
What cures?
What cures? What about Mrs. M. of Dallas, Texas? Mrs. M. came to me with an oolong fixation. She thought she was a tea bag. Well, I kept her in hot water for 3 months. She left here cured.
She paid you for keeping her in hot water?
I soaked her for $200, yes. Take my other cure, the brothers J. of Biddeford, Maine.
What was the matter with them?
The brothers J. thought they were bookends. They were going through life 6 inches apart. I walked between them saying, I am the Encyclopedia Britannica. The bookend fixation was shattered. The brothers left my clinic through different windows, cured.
That shuts me up.
Another cure. I am uncanny.
Excuse me, doctor.
Yes, 702.
I feel the urge.
Very well, 702. Here's your piece of bread.
Thank you. Who is that?
702 thinks she's a hamburger. Has to have a piece of bread before she'll sit down. I keep slicing the bread thinner and thinner. She'll be on her own in no time. Take a note for the medical journal.
Yes, sir.
Case 648, a specimen of exalted ego inflation. 648 was under the delusion that he was the president. By degrees, I reduced him to thinking he was vice president, then secretary of the interior, then Saul Bloom.
His ego was subsiding.
His ego was subsiding rapidly. Yesterday, I had him down to thinking he was a Republican. He was practically cured.
What happened?
I must have gone too far with my treatment. This morning, he woke up thinking he was Jack Benny. Well, I took him to the isolation ward, a hopeless moron. Oh, this must be a new patient. Put on your shoes, nurse, and open the door.
Yes, sir.
Professor Allen.
Be seated, please.
No, hold on. Now, just a minute. I've got something...
Oh, yes. You are a victim of repression.
No, here. Let go of my tongue. I'm not a patient.
No?
No, you maniac. I'm Rodney Tate, manager of the Cosmopolitan Opera Company.
But I'm not...
Our opera season opens tonight, and I'm terribly worried about our star center.
Florence Flibbert?
Yes. He's a victim. A victim of recurring hallucinations.
What form has Flibbert's phobia assumed?
He thinks he's a chicken.
A chicken?
Yes, a chicken.
His condition has been brought on by some foul experience. Am I right?
Yes. Mr. Flibbert made a concert appearance last week.
Yes?
Variety, a theatrical weekly, ran a headline.
Saying?
Flibbert lays an egg.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Flibbert is an artist. He began to brood about this thing.
That egg-laying phrase has perforated his subconscious.
Exactly. Today at rehearsal, Mr. Flibbert started flapping his arms and crowing in a finale.
He didn't follow through.
No. No. Mr. Flibbert did not lay an egg. No.
Good, good. Where is the patient now?
He's right outside. I'll call him in here. Florence, come in.
I'm a chicken.
Isn't that pitiful?
Dad, definite symptoms of poultry mania, a form of dementia peacocks. Mr. Flibbert.
I'm a chicken.
No. Mr. Flibbert. You have no feathers, you see? That proves you're not a chicken, doesn't it?
No, it proves I'm molting.
Flibbert has got to sing tonight. He's starring in Rigoletto.
Now, don't worry, Mr. Tate.
Well, I can't.
I'll clear up, peace of mind, Tate, old man. We have enough trouble with Flibbert here. I'll clear up Flibbert's condition in time for his performance.
Can you guarantee a cure, Professor?
Absolutely.
Good.
I shall start treatment immediately.
I'm a chicken.
Quiet, Mr. Flibbert. No breath. bragging. Now, Mr. Tate?
Yes, Professor.
You take Flibbert inside to my clinic.
Yes.
And squat him on an electric light bulb.
Yes.
When he sees he cannot hatch it, presto, the delusion will be shattered.
Oh, yes.
Flibbert will return to his normal senses.
Indeed, yes. Come along, Todd.
But, Bob, get me a list. I want to sit down.
I'll get
come
it.
On.
An interesting specimen, eh, nurse?
If that guy's a chicken, make mine pot roast.
Your sang froid is out of place in psychoanalysis circles, nurse. What is that letter on your desk there?
It's in case 527.
Oh, yes. 527 checked out 10 days ago, completely cured. Well, it's probably another testimonial. What does he say?
Dear Professor Allen,
yes.
2 weeks ago, I came to you obsessed with the idea that I was Al Jolson.
Yes?
You cured me in 3 days and discharged me.
Go on.
Now that I'm back in Hollywood, an embarrassing situation has come up. It seems that I really am Al Jolson. As a result of your cure, no one can make me believe I'm myself. What shall I do? Signed, Al Jolson.
Yeah, the distortion of individuation. I treated Dr. Jekyll for the same trouble. Take a letter.
Yes, sir.
Dear Al, if you really are Jolson, get down on one knee. Say mammy 50 times. It will all come back to you in blackface. Have you got that?
Yes, sir.
Are you in again? Where's that manager of yours?
I am right here, Professor. That confounded cure of yours didn't work at all.
Impossible.
Well, it didn't work.
You sat Flibbert on the light bulb as I prescribed?
Yes, I did, but the darn thing broke. He thought he'd laid a scrambled egg.
Yeah, the yolk was on me.
Quiet,
now, Flibbert. Alan, you have got to do something. I'm holding you responsible for this man.
I'll come through, Tate. My next move is auto-suggestion.
What is that?
Take Flibbert back to my clinic.
Yes.
Put some paper bloomers on him. He'll stop thinking he's a lamb chop. We can proceed from there.
Oh, yes. Good. Very well. Come on, Tony.
Bob, put me in a kettle. I want to be quick.
You're going to be a lamb chop. Now get in
there. Dad, this Flibbert case is extending me neurotically. Professor Allen's psychoanalysis clinic, inhibitions especially. Hello?
I want to speak to Professor Allen, please.
You're speaking to Professor Allen, madam.
What became of the man who answered the telephone?
I am the man who answered the telephone.
Oh, put Professor Allen on, please.
I am Professor Allen.
Really? Who was that other man who answered the phone?
It was I. I am Professor Allen.
One at a time, gentlemen, please.
Hello?
Who is this, please?
Professor Allen talking.
You're on a busy wire, Professor.
I know it. You called me up, madam.
So I did. Professor, I've got to see you.
I should say so.
When can I have an appointment?
Let me see. Friday.
Oh, I can't come Friday. I'm mad at Friday.
You're mad at Friday?
Yes. I like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and all the others.
But you're...
Yes, I'm mad at Friday.
Who are you, madam?
I'm Mrs. Robinson Crusoe.
Mad at Friday? That woman is crazy, nurse. Hello?
That party reversed the charges.
Dad, she isn't as crazy as I thought. Any patients waiting, nurse?
No, sir. But, Gawk, I'm still a chicken. But, Gawk.
A chicken, of course.
That is awful, Alan. I've never seen anything like it.
Confound him. Isn't he cured yet?
No, Alan, Mr. Flibbert is not cured.
Mr. Tate.
You guaranteed to get Mr. Flibbert in shape to sing tonight. He's still a chicken. I'm suing you. I'll ruin your clinic.
Hold on. I'll have you here for observation if you don't watch it, Tate. I will cure Mr. Tibbet, or Mr. Flibbert. I will cure him if he shows up, too. Come here. You're a chicken. In fact, Mr. Flibbert, you're such a fat little chicken, I'm going to eat you for dinner.
What?
Come here, Flibbert.
Wait a minute. What are you doing with that paperweight there, Professor?
I'm going to kill a chicken.
No.
Flibbert, take this.
Stop, wait a minute. Alan, what have you done? You'll get 20 years for this.
Quiet, Tate. I'll dash some water in the patient's face. We'll see how my shock treatment works. Here, Flibbert.
Who's on?
see me neither. Where am I?
Gordon!
Gordon, how do you feel?
Why, I feel fine. Why aren't we at the opera, Kate? What am I doing here?
Now, it's all right, Torrance. You were a chicken, but the professor just cured you. Alan, you're a genius.
Oh, yes.
Oh, it was nothing. Here is your bill, Mr. Flitter.
Oh, you get my check in the morning, Professor. I've got to rush over to the opera house.
Yes, we must. Just one thing, Professor.
Yes?
There's no danger of a relapse, is there?
None whatsoever.
Oh, good.
Unless Mr. Flibbert is exposed to another sudden shock. Keep him away from those bad notices.
Yes, fine, fine. The opera house will never forget you, Professor. We'll name the men's foyer and the mezzanine after you, sir.
Ah, that is inferior immortality, and thank you.
Yes.
Good day, gentlemen.
Good day, Professor. Good day.
And remember, Papa, Mr. Flibbert, avoid any sudden shock.
I will.
You are wonderful, Professor.
Thank you, nurse. My psychotherapy never fails.
Alan, you no good sizzling bamboozler.
Mr. Tate, what is this?
You told Mr. Flipper to keep away from sudden shock.
But
he just looked at your bill. It's for $10,000.
It's itemized. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that, he asked. What's wrong with it? I'll show you what's wrong with it. Torrance, come in here.
I'm a chicken.
He's a chicken.
As we come to the end of another year, ladies and gentlemen, we want to thank every one of you sincerely for the part you have played in making Ipana toothpaste the undisputed leader in its field. You know the splendid job Ipana does in cleaning your teeth. You know how Ipana massage helps strengthen your gums, makes them less susceptible to trouble.
But do you know what goes on behind the scenes to assure you that Ipana will always meet your most exacting requirements?
At the Ipana plant in Hillside, New Jersey, in one of the best research laboratories of its kind in the world, there is a staff of technical experts, including graduate chemists from the foremost universities here and abroad, to ensure the recognized high quality of Ipana toothpaste. In addition, the makers of Ipana employ an independent research laboratory and have even established a fellowship in one of our leading universities for further research in dental hygiene. That's why Ipana is so highly regarded, and why so many dentists recommend the daily use of Ipana and gum massage. So you can readily understand why your favorite toothpaste is America's largest selling toothpaste, Ipana.
Well, that about winds up our last program for 1939, ladies and gentlemen. We wish you all a happy and prosperous new year. And don't forget, our first show of the new year next week brings you your song of the week. What does that mean, that polymois d'amour?
It loses so much in its range.
Oh, well, I... And our guest star will be...
Carl Johnson, the youngest cornet player in the world.
And music.
The National Broadcasting Company.